We have at last caught up with a very, very busy, productive, interesting, and interested young man, Matt O'Coyne. You have probably begun to see references to him in the press and media in Chicago. You may have already seen references to him on the East Coast or in San Antonio not too long ago. Matt O'Coyne is the Sir George Schulte Conducting Fellow, the second one at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, selected for that position by Riccardo Muti. He is also a composer with a commission, which we'll come to the details of, from the Metropolitan Opera, and a recently announced commission from the Lyric Opera of Chicago for August of 2015, a family opera that's going to be performed at and in the Lincoln Park Zoo, and we're going to hear about that. He's also going to be the librettist for that opera because he's also a writer and he's a poet and, at least in a classroom, a critic of poetry, and he has studied with and worked with Jory Graham. For Chicagoans, it's a different Jory Graham. This is the poet Jory Graham, J-O-R-I-E, who was, I think, for many, many years at Iowa. Now she's at
That's
Harvard.
That's right.
Is that right? And he's probably really embarrassed and upset that I'm giving this long introduction, but I need to at least lay out these four areas of his life and work. You're 24, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And I need to lay out this background so that you'll get an idea of why this might be even more of a pinball game conversation than sometimes. So welcome to Chicago. Actually, your formal name is Matthew, but we're going to call you Matt because that's what you want to be called. Welcome to Chicago. Welcome to WFMT. And to start off, why don't you tell us how you describe yourself?
You know, it's not a question I'm very good at answering. I'm better at being myself than, than describing myself. With the proverbial gun to my head, I would say I'm a composer.
Okay.
You know, I write music, but the strange thing is that for me, music and words are on a continuum. You know, words are little bundles of music, and what we call human music sort of strives to be like speech. We shape sound into these forms with which we communicate. So I'd like to think of myself as a maker of music in all different forms, whether that's a piece of music that other people can play, or whether it's a poem, or whether it's a performance that I myself conduct. That's pretty much it.
I think that's a both a very good description and an accurate one, and also a useful one to think about. I left out that she played the piano, too. I mean, in public as well as for yourself.
Sometimes I do.
Okay.
I inflict that upon listeners.
And tell us a bit about your background. I mean, you come from Boston or the Boston area, as well as having gone to college there. Your dad has been, or is he still, the theater critic at the Boston Globe?
At the Globe, yeah.
Right. Okay. So tell us a bit about where you came from.
I grew up in a small town called Medfield, small burb outside of Boston. And then I went to Harvard in Cambridge, which is pretty close, but it's a different world. You know, my town has horses and fields, and it's very idyllic, and Cambridge is that, you know, bustling microcosm of life. And I've been making music up for about as long as I can remember. Since I was, you know, 6 or 7, it was just, I wanted to play piano, but the piano was just like a box of crayons with which I could make stuff up. And the conducting piece of the picture is a relatively recent addition. While I was at Harvard, there's an amazing music scene at Harvard. It's very student run. There are all these people who are like, well, I'm not sure if I'm going to be a doctor or a violinist. So what differentiates them from a student at a conservatory maybe is that they do something else during the day, but they want to play. They desperately want to play, and they maybe aren't doing it formally all the time. So if you want to conduct stuff, it's pretty easy to throw together a really good ensemble and say, let's do The Marriage of Figaro in a new English translation in a dining hall, which
right.
we did.
Right.
So that's, I feel like that's where I started to cut my teeth.
I have a friend who's now in his early 60s. Wow, that means I must be in my mid-50s. But anyway, he went to Harvard, undergrad, later to Harvard Law School. And every once in a while, particularly since YouTube has spread, emerged and spread, he'll post something up online and saying, three of my classmates playing a trio in the dining hall of my residence hall at Harvard in 19 whatever, wonder whatever happened to them. And the cellist is Yo-Yo Ma, and the violinist is a doctor, and I can't remember if it's a string trio or a pianist, but the other person went on to also to a professional career, maybe not one of the millions who was at the level of Yo-Yo's career. But my point is that I've seen this over time. And of course, can remember Andrew Porter writing in The New Yorker about this kid at Harvard named Peter Sellers, with an A, who was putting on operas. And he thought that Peter was going to go somewhere. So
Whatever happened to him.
So it's definitely part of, you know, people here, I think particularly outside of the East, they hear Harvard and they assume people are putting their nose up or boasting or claiming certain things. And usually what people, though, talk about is their classmates, their activities, and the opportunities they had to meet other exciting young people who wanted to try things. I hear very few people talk beyond their favorite teacher or something about their actual classes. So I think that is something that is a positive thing.
Yeah, some people don't spend much time in the classroom. If you want to do something like composing operas, which I do, try finding a class for that anywhere, at a conservatory, at a liberal arts college. I don't think it exists.
Yeah.
And so it was actually really good training to just go, well, I'm just going to do it. Is anybody else crazy enough to hop on this boat with me? And there were, and we were able to.
So what were some of the things that you wrote and put on then?
Oh gosh.
If you can think back that far.
There's a, there's a one act opera that I'm not sure if it'll ever see the light of day again, called From Sandover, based on James Merrill's epic poem, The Changing Light at Sandover, which is a kind of Ouija board.
Literally.
Epic. Literally, yeah. It's you know, two people at a Ouija board and various spirits walking in and out. We did that in you can't make this up, but we did it in a hall in the Agassiz Theater in Cambridge, that we booked the hall without knowing there was anything particularly special about it. And then we discovered that it was actually where James Merrill filmed the movie version of the same piece in the 80s.
Wow.
You know, and my advisor.
So you felt like a giant Ouija board was pushing you. Well,
absolutely, I was just.
Or the reader on the board.
Yeah. A piece in that puzzle.
Yeah.
So that was cool. I wrote an opera based on the life of the poet Hart Crane. The opera's just called Hart Crane. I mean, the guy's life was just like an opera waiting to happen. And then there
complete
are a million
tragic ending and
yeah, premature and, yeah. tragic ending. The whole
odes
shebang.
To the Brooklyn Bridge. Right. Yeah, it's all
exactly.
there.
And, you know, just a million smaller things. The guitarist of the band Incubus came back to study after being in this successful rock band for ages, and he put together all kinds of wild projects. And once he was supposed to compose a piece for some occasion on campus and had to cancel because he was sick. And so I wrote something in, like, a couple of days. It was really boot camp for, you know, being the kind of short order cook that a lot of composers have had to be. And it's not, you know, how to put it, it's not a sustainable way of living. It's just too crazy.
Right.
But it's a good thing to put yourself through once if you want to write music.
I have a pretty clear sense, maybe it's a cliched term now, but you carry a great deal of what people might call an old soul with you. I mean, you could be dropped into earlier times in this century and maybe even prior centuries. You obviously seem very comfortable with history and literature and so on. Yet at the same time, you're born and raised in a totally digital world. So I'm curious, I'm always curious how people compose physically, but I'm particularly curious how somebody who probably knew how to text or something before he necessarily knew how to load a fountain pen.
That's a really good question. I'm addicted to the physical sensation of writing notes onto a page. For me, the channeling from head through arm through pen into paper is, I mean, it actually changes the way that I compose. So I do use Sibelius, the computer program that is a godsend for all composers. But unless I'm pressed, I always write things out by
hand. You don't start there. Yeah.
But, you know, the influence of the digital world and electronically made music on me has been important, because in high school I played in a rock band for quite a while.
What did you play?
Keys and, you know, sang, which was a bad idea.
For most rock bands.
Yeah, exactly. But the sound world of bands like Radiohead struck me as more organic in a way than some of the so-called classical music, the acoustically based music. And, you know, the more I study that music, Radiohead in particular, they actually engineer their albums to resemble an orchestral texture. The way that the voice fits in, the way that these supposedly man-made digital sounds relate to one another, it's totally an orchestral sensibility. And that was one of the things that led me back to writing music for acoustic instruments is, you know, everything I'm trying to do in a band with these fancy machines, I think I could do even more accurately and more freely just writing it down.
Yeah. Matt O'Coin was making a big smile, voluntarily or involuntarily, probably, while he was relating that story. And I think you could hear his enthusiasm, too, and you get a sense of how his mind, both in a situation and retrospectively, sees how different things get put together. So you were writing these pieces and putting them on, and you were also conducting them, at least in some cases.
Yes,
right?
I mean, no one else was going to do it.
Right. Now, had you picked up a pencil or a baton and waved it around before that time, or did you start to
Not
do it because
before,
of to realize these pieces?
Yeah, it was to realize those pieces. I studied with Federico Cortese, the head of the Harvard Orchestra, and a wonderful teacher.
But so this is a student orchestra, but directed by a professional at the school.
Exactly.
Right. Then you were also conducting other things with the orchestra. And I know this because my friend Alex Ross is how I first heard about you, because Alex, who was an undergraduate at Harvard and whose thing was the radio station, which is very similar in some ways to what you're describing with your opera or theater or these other groups, because you have a guy who's been there forever who makes sure that all the machines go on, that people learn how to use logbooks and how to look at the clock and that kind of thing. But every year, you know, a quarter of the people disappear and a quarter come, and every 4 years it's a new group of people, and they're free to experiment and create within, most of them within the range of quote-unquote classical, but that can extend to Radiohead and many other ways, backwards, forwards, and sideways. But
you got to love that station, by the way. You know, their famous orgies.
The orgies,
of, you know,
where they'll play
5 days at a time.
Composer X or whatever.
A friend of mine was doing the classical station, and they were doing a John Cage orgy, which is probably enough to strike fear into the hearts of listeners. And they had to interrupt, this is ironic, the orgy for a church service, which the station had to broadcast every Sunday morning. And they were thinking, well, gosh, is it still really an orgy if we interrupt it? And then they could only do this with Cage. They found a piece that whose instructions are, you know, a ritual takes place or something like that.
And they timed
it. And so they thought, great, we'll just count the church service as part of the orgy.
These were almost mythical for decades. Now you can actually stream WHRB,
yes.
And I think it's whrb.org, but you can just type in WHRB into your computer and you'll find it, and you can discover the critics and radio programmers and writers of the future. But Alex would tell me, and I'm going to embarrass you a little bit, that he was getting some contact and some recordings from a kid at Harvard, and
I think he heard my Tristan prelude.
And yeah, you were doing heavy duty stuff, and he said, this guy is someone to keep your eyes open and ears open for. So I was the one person who was not completely surprised when you appeared in Chicago.
I was completely surprised.
I said I was the one. So what were you doing and learning with conducting? What were you doing and learning with Mr. Cortese, et cetera?
Oh, just the mechanics such as they can be learned. Mm-hmm. It's a very hands-on craft, and it's one that I would make no claims of mastering. It's something that I want to let set in for, what, decades? When do conductors ripen? When they turn 76? But I was learning by doing, and, you know, fell on my face a fair amount. But if you do something like Figaro, a piece that has so much hidden emotional depth and so many tricky turns, and you're doing it entirely with people who've never done it before, yourself included, you end up making discoveries because you don't have someone telling you, you must not take this tempo here because, you know, someone did it in 1837 and it was bad.
Right.
You find it out for yourself. You know, you do the piece the way you have to do it.
And look, so that's what I was doing. Any art form or any collaborative art form in particular, you have a group of poets who don't even know they're poets yet, and they meet in a bar or a coffee shop, and they start driving around the country and writing poems. Or you have these kids who love movies in France, and they start watching lots of movies, and they say, well, we should start making movies. They don't even know what a camera is. And they become the most famous film directors of the middle of the 20th century. And I'm not saying it works for everybody, but that's when there's that energy, you do learn how to learn in some ways, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. I was once asked, you know, when I made the career decision to go into music.
Right.
And it honestly took me, I was a bit taken aback because it was, I never thought of it as a career decision.
Right, right.
It was a life decision.
Right.
And the career part got swept up in the wave.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I'm happy about.
It sounds like your life decision, though, was just to keep being. It wasn't that by this year I will be a conducting fellow and then I will have my opera performed at the Lincoln Park Zoo. And,
I mean, you didn't have every composer's dream.
Right. Now, we know that Mr. Muti believes very strongly, some might even say aggressively so, that a conductor of an orchestra must come out of opera and vocal connections, or at least must steep him or herself in that and have certain abilities. And to even audition for this fellowship, my understanding is you lead singers from a piano in excerpts or prep for various works. So that already makes a certain cut, which might be an arbitrary cut, but it's a cut for this position, because Hector Berlioz could not have been in this competition unless he was allowed to conduct from the guitar. So what did you do for this, and what was all of that audition process like?
It was wonderful, and it was torture at the same time. I have to tell an embarrassing story, which is that they originally sent out a list of scores to learn, which was, it was gigantic. It was like 15 scores. And I thought, oh my gosh, how do they expect, you know, busy young conductors to learn all this stuff? But I did and lugged all the scores across the country to the audition. And then at the hotel, I found the actual list, which was only 5 or 6 of those. I had missed an email somewhere. And so I broke my back.
Be prepared that eventually we will narrow down from this list to 5 or 6.
And I missed that memo. So I was super prepared. And in the first round, we had a choice on the opera side. We had to conduct both operatic and symphonic excerpts. And I remember that the choice was something from Bellini's Norma or Mozart's Così fan tutte. And I'd conducted more Mozart than Bellini, but sort of on a whim, I asked, hey, who's on the panel? Can you tell me who's on the panel yet? Oh, Marilyn Horne was on the panel. Now, Marilyn Horne's one of the great interpreters of Bellini ever.
Right.
So I thought,
she helped put him back on the map.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I thought, I can't pass up a chance to conduct Casta Diva for Marilyn Horne.
So you didn't say, Marilyn Horne's on the panel, Mozart's looking really good. You said, if I'm going to do this, I should do this for Marilyn Horne. Do it for Jackie.
That's That's what I felt.
Uh-huh.
And then in the second round, another thing that you couldn't have made up. Well, you didn't have choice at that point. They just picked the piece for you.
Right.
They picked Act 4 of Verdi's Otello for me. And
no intimidation in doing that for Ricardo Muti.
You know, it's personally significant for me because when I saw Maestro Muti do Otello a few years earlier, mm-hmm. I snuck down to Carnegie Hall to see him do it with the CSO. It was really a transformative moment for me because Otello is a piece that I would rank as high as anything ever written. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a total masterpiece. When I saw him do it, I had this feeling of, oh, I never thought I would see Verdi done this way in my mm-hmm. lifetime.
Meaning
with a complete understanding of time as space, mm-hmm. you know, treating time like this field that unfolds and giving all this music, which seems simple, but actually has a lot of depth, all the time it needs to breathe. And to hear all the inner colors, the stuff that people sometimes pass over, like it's, you know, street band music or mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was this moment of, okay, it's possible, so I've got to hold myself to this standard. Because mm-hmm. I've seen it's possible.
Right.
You know, even in 2011 or whenever it was. Right. So to conduct it for Maestro Muti was pretty cool.
What do you have, the Civic Orchestra?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it felt comfortable somehow. Yeah, it felt good.
Well, that's always the best, isn't it? When you see somebody or connect with somebody who's an idol and who is an inspiration, and rather than being intimidated, it hits that part of you that flowers, and then you can show them what you've got. Maybe it'll be great, maybe it won't be, but it's going to be you, and they're going to actually lift your performance. So it worked.
I suppose.
And what do you do in this fellowship? This is only the second one, so it's probably still being defined both in terms of what the program is and how your schedule works, the CSO's schedule, the maestros, and so on. But what has it been so far? I mean, you had a letter from your mom that you were busy at the Met or something and you couldn't start early, right?
A doctor's note from New York. Yeah. Basically, I'm spending about half of the season this year and next mm-hmm. In Chicago, especially when Maestro Muti is here, studying him in action and taking a more hands-on approach with the Civic Orchestra, conducting them in rehearsals and getting to know those players, and also traveling sometimes with the maestro. I'd done some work at the Rome Opera where he's music director, mm-hmm. so it's only natural to accompany him there and help out.
You'd already done something.
I had, yeah.
What did you do there?
I did one orchestral concert, and I was assistant on The Nose, which was, the first time.
Oh, great, Shostakovich.
Yeah, the Shostakovich.
Which first was, time it was done there?
Yeah, that was a trip.
I can imagine. Yeah. So you were there for the Manon Lescaut, the Puccini?
I was not, actually.
Ah, okay.
I was back here.
You were there for the Verdi? Or
for the Ernani.
For the Ernani,
in the fall,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was really hoping that you were there for the Puccini, because that's an example of, you hear Verdi, Otello, CSO, Muti, and, you know, whether it's Carnegie Hall or Kuala Lumpur, you're going to be there. And then you hear Muti, Anna Trebko, Manon Lescaut, Puccini, and you think, wow, if I were there, that would be really interesting. And then talking with people about it, and then talking with Muti about it before and after he did it, it was clear that, I'm not going to say the piece is Otello or the B minor mass or anything, but it was clear that he had not only applied that same 3D or 4D, because it's time as well, X-ray reconstruction, but he'd gotten Netrebko to play along with it and come to all the rehearsals, not even just all of her rehearsals. That's a feat. And then you had this range of critics who wouldn't normally even necessarily be on the same page at all, but the the main critic in Italy, the main critic in Germany, and Zach Wolf from the New York Times, writing reviews that were almost identical to each other about how, wow, there's a piece of music here, and so on. So I was really curious if, you know, if you had seen that happen, but you already have obviously imagined it because you've seen it happen now with these other works.
Yes.
Do you work with Cliff Colnott when you're working with Civic, or do you they just bring you in and throw you in front of them, or?
It depends.
Yeah.
I've certainly seen some of Cliff's rehearsals, but I've also had some of my own.
And then do you and Muti go for walks around the block where he imparts wisdom and tells you anecdotes, or is it more of a watching the rehearsal, asking questions about that?
I certainly talk to him in rehearsals.
Yeah.
But as anyone who's seen the maestro with the CSO knows, one of his gifts is showing with a total economy of gesture. Just, you know, what not to show is every bit as important as what he does show. So I think the most valuable stuff that I'm learning from the maestro are just kind of absorbing things, you know, by osmosis.
Right. And I mean, that is the way in I think particularly in conducting, because there isn't a school, really. There are schools, quote-unquote, but it has to come from experience. And interesting that you mentioned, too, about the gestures, because, and Muti would be the first to say this. In fact, I got him to say it in front of a room of 35 critics yesterday, the day before we're speaking, at the hall, and that is that in his career, which is now almost 50 years, he has greatly, in the last 10 or 15 years, economized his own gestures. So you're at the beginning of the arc, and you're watching somebody who's already gone through what you're starting to go through. And yet, there is something to be said about learning from that end, because you can sort of put together what led up to that, and you can kind of see where the refinement took him, right? I mean, if you study a poet, you would probably later study his or her juvenilia. You wouldn't start off by saying, well, this is something Auden wrote when he was 11, and this is what he wrote when he was 12.
Yeah, it's useful to conduct your own music, because I find that when I'm doing something of mine, I don't do anything extraneous, because it feels natural, because it came naturally out of me. And so I find that I actually conduct better. So the challenge is to bring that ease, that naturalness, to when you're conducting other people's music.
Right.
To sort of create the illusion that you wrote it.
Right.
Which sounds egotistical or something to say. But actually, it's only in the moment of performance that you give in to that illusion.
Right.
And say, this is happening right now.
Right.
There are sort of two illusions that you have to let yourself succumb to, I think. You know, when you're composing, the scary thing is that it seems like you're starting from nothing. And so you have to remind yourself that you're not actually starting from nothing. There's you. There's something in there that is going to make the music happen, even if the page is blank. And in conducting, it's the reverse. It looks like there's a lot there already. There's the score. But you have to create the illusion that it's not there and that it's just happening.
Yeah.
And that's why I love going back and forth between composing and conducting, because the two processes have a lot to say to each other. They're totally different as far as technique and mindset, but they build each other.
We're talking with Matt Aucoin, A-U-C-O-I-N, composer and maker of music in many different ways. I think that's the term we've come down on. Let's talk a bit about the composition projects that you have that are commissioned by or connected with big buildings that people have heard about. Tell us about what you're doing with the Met, and tell us about the Lyric Unlimited project that you're doing with Lyric Opera of Chicago.
The opera for the Met is barely even an embryo yet. It's not even an infant. So I'm afraid I can't say much about the piece. I can only
say something about what it's for or whatever. I'm sorry.
It's part of the New Works program at the Met, which had its first main stage production this year with Nico Muhly's Two Boys. And the wonderful thing about it is that there's no deadline. As you probably know, the Met plans sometimes decades into the future. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if I wrote the piece tomorrow, it still would take a long time to be workshopped and for the company to figure out what to do with it. So I'm planning to just clear the decks starting next year and take the time that the piece needs.
Are you given parameters of any kind in terms of size of cast or length or... We know language apparently is an issue because somebody else who was yes. commissioned wrote his opera in French and they said, no, you're North American. You have to write it in English and dot, dot, dot. Mine, it was done somewhere else.
It won't be in Swahili.
Okay.
Promise. Put it this way. There are no specific guidelines, but whatever I come up with, they would have to approve,
right,
certainly.
Right, right.
But we'll see where that
okay,
goes.
Okay.
The piece I should probably talk about that's coming up sooner is the opera called Crossing, which I've composed for the American Repertory Theater.
Please.
Which opens in Boston next May.
And this is the theater, the professional theater at Cambridge.
Yes, they are based in Cambridge. We're using one of the Boston opera houses, the Schubert Theater, for this piece because, after all, it's an opera.
Right.
Diane Paulus, the artistic director of ART, is directing the piece, and I actually owe the piece's existence to Diane. She came to me right when I was graduating and said, would you like to write something for us? Can it vaguely involve the Civil War? Because there's this sort of anniversary season. And to be...
Which is big in that area, obviously. There's a lot of history there.
Yep. Lots of heavy history. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, my first reaction was, I don't know if that's for me. Mm-hmm. You know, the Civil War, I mean, you can sort of picture the red badge of courage, the opera, and it's kind of a depressing spectacle, you know.
Right.
People, army hymns, and it's just, ugh, that's not me. But then I read Walt Whitman's diaries, mm-hmm. reread them, mm-hmm. From when he was a nurse during mm-hmm. the Civil War. And it's just this amazing study in... Not even a study. It's an effort to keep the individual level of human contact alive mm-hmm. in a war that for the first time had casualties numbering in the tens of thousands.
Right.
It totally freaked Whitman out, you know.
Right.
How do you process 10,000 people dying on one field in one day? So he sort of became obsessed with painting these individual portraits of mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm.
Here's this soldier. He was 19 years old. He died today. This is... You know, this is some stories about him. So I got the idea to set an opera in a kind of purgatory space where there's a Whitman figure who's also kind of like Dante in mm-hmm. in purgatory, talking to the people who were there. Everyone seems to have something to tell. No one's mm-hmm. quite sure if they're alive or dead. No mm-hmm. one's sure if they're going to make it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I wrote the piece, the more it started to be about the Whitman figure and how he's sort of trapped there as much as anybody else,
right.
Rather than just being a healer. So we're very excited. That opens in May. The baritone Rod Guilfrey.
May of, born of 15.
Yeah, May of 15.
Mm-hmm. Rod Guilfrey.
Is our Whitman, mm-hmm. part he was born to play.
Right.
And we've got this wonderful young orchestra, A Far Cry, in the pit.
Right.
And normally they're conductorless, and I'm very grateful that they've agreed that since this is an opera,
right.
you know, there should be someone checking in. So I'll be doing that.
And is it going to be a monodrama, or there will be these other characters as well? But
it's quite
Guilfrey,
a full cast.
Whitman
yeah.
is the middle of it. Okay.
It's about a dozen individuals, and they kind of function as a chorus too.
Right. This is, of course, fascinating for many reasons. One thing is there's a very nice Chicago symmetry here because Diane Paulus had never done an opera. In fact, I think she told us in a taping here when she made her debut in Chicago, she really hadn't been to the opera. She had done the Donkey Show downtown in New York, which was this kind of cabaret club redoing of Midsummer Night's Dream. Brian Dickey, who had really just arrived in Chicago as head of Chicago Opera Theater, had been told to check her out, said, I want you to do an opera. She said, what? And then he said, and I've got this conductor in mind. She's never been to the United States, but the two of you are going to hit it off wonderfully. And Jane Glover's American career started, and Diane's opera career started right here. And over time, they did all the DuPonte operas here, and they did other projects. It started with Figaro or John G. Anyway, it's this is the kind of stuff that falls out of my head. The basic points, though, are there, and it was great to sort of watch Diane emerge, and then, you know, she would have done many of these things anyway, win Tonys and do hair and take over ART. But the opera part, I think it was nice to know that it was something that was going on here with that kind of let's put on a show. Yes. Most of these small opera companies, however old they are, their budgets are day to day, month to month, year to year. And it's sort of, what can your creativity... No, it started, of course, with they did the Monteverdi trilogy. It started with Orfeo. That's what it started with. And I think Diane had never heard of Monteverdi, but she created with Jane perhaps one of the finest Monteverdi productions anybody had seen. So that's a wonderful thing to sort of see that she does that now with people.
I didn't know her as an opera director either. I knew her, of course, as a director of musicals and plays, but when she approached me, it was with this sense of, gosh, I really miss opera. I'd love to do another one.
Wow.
And I remember joking to her after I saw Pippin on Broadway, which is the most spectacular in literal sense of it's a spectacle, you know, half naked acrobats and everything. I thought, you know, Diane, I really have to add some more fire breathing acrobats to my opera. I'm not sure I can compete.
Yeah. Is she going to be directing?
She will direct, yes. Right.
Whitman, of course, is somebody you can't ever complete. I mean, you can go back to his poem, which is his life poem. You can go back to his letters, his diaries, and they always take you somewhere. And even this aspect, of course, Adams has done something with his poetry drawn from this period with the Wound Dresser, right?
Yes.
And but it's not any kind of a repetition, because Whitman will repeat himself for you if he wants to, and he can contain multitudes. But
exactly,
he must also be one of these, just similar to what you said in a way about Marilyn Horne. He must be just a constant inspiration too.
He is. It's funny you should bring up the poetry from the Civil War period, like The Wound Dresser. Most of the Whitman poetry that surfaces in the opera is actually not from that period. I don't like it as much, frankly.
Right.
I think he did his...
It's more overblown. It's more
kind of overblown.
Formal.
There's lots of look at those drums and look at those golden-thighed farm boys, you know, walking in formation.
Right.
I kind of think there was a personal crisis.
Oh, there was, yeah.
In there, you can't locate it exactly.
Right.
But after a lot of the poems that are just the absolute best, you know, the Song of Myself level, there's a strange evolution, and I want to catch that in my portrayal of Whitman, the personal growth, the mysteries, the stuff that we really won't know, because Whitman at his best as a poet doesn't even need to be depicted as an opera character.
Right.
I mean,
right.
it just speaks for itself.
It's already there. One more question about Crossing, and will it be a conventional orchestra in terms of scoring and numbers of players and acoustic nature of instruments, or will there be some additional or different take there?
It will, yeah.
Yeah.
In my last opera, in Hart Crane, there is one exception. There's an electric guitar in the pit. A friend of mine, Zach Trahan, is a fantastic sort of guitarist and maker of like soundscapes. And it was some of the most ravishingly beautiful sounds that he created. But I didn't feel like I integrated it well enough. And I don't feel yet like I know how to do that.
Right.
And I'm not sure... I often feel like when I hear electronic stuff mingled with acoustic performances, it doesn't feel organic to me often.
Mm-hmm. No, I disagree. Right.
We'll see where that goes.
Second Nature. Is that the name?
That's the name.
That's the Linkin Park Zoo Opera. Tell us about how this all came about and how it's going to happen. Because it'll be just a few months after the Crossing. Or Crossing, excuse me,
I owe the existence of of second nature to another really strong woman in the opera world, which is Renee Fleming, who, in her capacity at Lyric as consultant, originally put me in touch with the company. She also saw Hart Crane in Cambridge. And we started talking about an opera for young
people. She had a daughter probably in school.
Exactly.
Around your class, if not your class.
A couple of years younger.
Okay.
Who was singing in the chorus in
Hart Crane. Right, and I understand that she was a good mom and frequently was around to hear programs.
Oh, well, I have a story about that too, which is okay. I was conducting Fledermaus with Amelia, who's a very talented singer, covering the role of Rosalinda, and we were doing a cover sing through, an understudy sing through at a dress rehearsal. And so I texted Amelia and said, "Hey, do you want to play through the part? How are you feeling?" And she said, "Of course, come on down. My mom's coaching me."
Sing out, so, Louise.
So, you know, playing through Fledermaus was a little bit more intense that day, but I learned a lot from it. Yeah. And then when I met with the folks at Lyric and started talking about the project, they said, "You can do whatever you want within reason, but remember that it will be premiered at the zoo. So if you could integrate something, I don't know, animals, the environment, rogue bear attacks, I don't know, whatever. give it a try." And I kind of ran with it.
The zoo might not like the rogue bear attacks.
That's
true.
The
opera might allow them.
Sorry, Lincoln Park Zoo. There's no rogue bear attacks at your zoo. I ran with that guideline and thought about what if, you know, 100 or so years in the future, we humans have messed up the environment sufficiently that we decide that it's not worth it to deal with nature anymore. But we have enough technological advancements to lock ourselves in a kind of bunker. And what if that bunker were a zoo? What if we just sort of invaded a zoo and decided that that was where we would live to be safe? Well, then I realized that space would be a kind of reverse Garden of Eden. You know, you're trapped inside, and there is a world out there that you're not supposed to go see. And it would take some kind of forbidden knowledge of what happened in the past to want to go out there. So the opera is set 100 years in the future, starring two kids who are born into this world. They've never known anything else, and they've been handed down this somewhat rosy picture of, oh, well, we humans decided that we would just have more fun if we didn't bother with the outside world, and that's that. And just like in the Garden of Eden, it takes exposure to something natural, fruit, which the monkey next door hands them. He's been secretly cultivating a real fruit tree, which is forbidden. And the kids taste it and they decide, whoa, maybe this is worth saving. Maybe nature is worth checking out again. So it's kind of a reverse myth.
Right.
You know, they taste the apple, and it's a forbidden apple, but maybe it's the thing that saves them rather than the thing that condemns them to a life of, you know, sin forever.
Yeah.
And I won't tell you how it ends.
No, please don't. And there must be parameters here about length and maybe even casting, because
it's quite short family and quite portable.
Yeah. And the idea is to, with hope that it succeeds, that it would then could be taken to other zoos, other parks in Chicago, other places.
And in fact, it will go on a tour of schools in the fall of 15.
Are these children singing, or are these grown-ups singing as children?
They're grown-ups singing as children.
Like Hansel and Gretel.
Like Hansel, exactly.
Okay.
Well, or, you know, cool. Cunning Little Vixen.
Right. And then what kind of an orchestra or band or accompaniment?
A very small chamber group.
But clearly you're as excited about that as you are about the deep, from top to bottom, Whitman kind of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that if opera is going to survive, and I believe it will, one thing it has to do is reach people in spaces where people can really feel it. You know, there was a time, maybe, when going to see a grand opera in a giant opera house was the last word in spectacle. It was the equivalent of a rock concert. But that sounds absurd today, right, when you can go to an arena and see a rock concert. Opera is not at its best when it's overblown and grand. It's at its best when it's intimate. Like, the thing that we all actually love about it is the power of an unamplified voice reaching you. And for me, the period of opera as spectacle was a fad, and we're better off without it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm every bit as excited to write a piece for the voice and for acoustic instruments in a small space where you can actually feel their power.
Mm-hmm.
I'm as excited to do that as to do it for a big house. I think that, even more broadly speaking, is classical music's like secret weapon.
Mm-hmm.
The thrill of the primal creation of music with either just the body, if you're singing, or the body and this crazy little acoustic machine. Do you necessarily feel it if you're sitting at the back of orchestra hall? I don't know. But mm-hmm. if you bring your friends into a room and give them a couple drinks and play a Brahms sextet, they're going to feel it.
Right.
So.
Right. There are a couple other things that brings to mind, and just the whole question of intimacy in performance. I think it can happen in large spaces when there's
sure.
a live thing, but it's when people understand that grand opera usually means the size of the orchestra and the need for maybe a large cast, and because of the settings, maybe large settings, but not large performances in the wrong way. For example, yes. ask anybody to tell you about the best Ring cycle or the best Le Trian, the Trojans of Berlioz, that the person saw. And they will, I think, without exception, say, it was the time I saw it at or in such and such, and it was like chamber music. The, yes. the songs were songs, and the plaints were plaintive to me. They weren't sinking to the rafters, quote unquote. And that can happen at the Met or Lyric or Bayreuth, or which is not that big physically, but I mean it's big. But that it's when there's an understanding that it's about communication. But when it's about the horns on the head or sets rolling in and out, and I'll say machines on the stage, you don't have to say that, then something gets lost, and grand gets bigger than opera in people's minds, or the same with an orchestra. But ask
no, totally. It's like opera's trying to compete with Hollywood on its own terms.
Right.
And it's never going to win.
Right.
You're never
right.
going to win that battle.
Right.
Just opera, be yourself.
Right.
You know, classical music, be yourself. It's worth it.
And the same, I think, for audiences. People will say to me, well, I don't know if I should bring my kids to X, Y, or Z. They're not ready. I say, what do they have to be ready for?
Yeah.
How many live performances have they seen? And if they take their kids to dance, theater, or concert, the kids are magnetized because they haven't seen anything live. They
right.
can't. And sometimes they might say, that's moving. I mean, fine, let them say that. But I mean, yes, once in a while you'll see someone have to carry a kid out or something. But in the main, they sit there, especially today, where they're so electronically supported. And they sit there and they're just absolutely amazed that something can be done with the human body and the human voice and nothing else. And then they want to come back. So it's not that the companies are necessarily, quote, failing, or the art forms are failing the audiences. Sometimes the audience is protecting itself too much, I think, or its next generation too much. But
yes,
you've mentioned some of the poets whose work you've set or whose stories you've worked on telling. Merrill, James Merrill, Hart Crane, Walt Whitman, John Ashbery, Jory Graham. Are there others, either from our century or from the past, who have a special meaning? I'm sure there are hundreds that matter to you. But
yeah, there are plenty. Elizabeth Bishop,
mm-hmm.
John Donne, Paul Celan, mm-hmm. Dante, all over the mm-hmm. map.
Sure. That reminds me, too, that this works on all ends. It used to be that among critics, first of all, you weren't necessarily only a critic of any one thing. You might you knew you had to know something about theater, to know something about music, to know something about literature. And it used to be not so uncommon that poets were writing about music or whatever. There's a little bit of it coming back, I think. Certainly in my period, generation ahead of me, but who I grew up with, Lloyd Schwartz, who's both a poet and writes about music, and of course was a friend of Elizabeth Bishop's. But I think that we've also, that's another area where we've lost that sense that these things are a part of the whole way that art is a human activity, and an activity that enables us to be human is by just reviewing things rather than engaging with them and allowing ourselves on this side of the footlights to be categorized or specialized rather than understanding that the O'Coin way is a way more people should try to
connect. I mean, I think I'm in a pretty open-minded generation.
Yeah.
I think we're going to be seeing a lot of interesting intermingling.
Yeah.
Because we live in a world where a lot of old categories are breaking down.
Right.
So people my age find some notions of genre sort of confusing. It's like, oh, why don't these two art forms collaborate?
Yeah.
It seems more natural
right.
that they would. I don't know how that applies to the future critics of my generation. That'll be interesting. I have to say I love it when critics are all over the map and really treat themselves as writers, you know, not just as news reporters about a concert that you probably didn't see, dear reader,
which
is the risk, you know.
Exactly.
It has to be entertaining
yeah.
for the reader.
Yeah. Tell us about your own writing of poetry.
I started writing the usual bad, you know, adolescent poems. And in college, my thesis was a book of poems.
Mm-hmm.
So
your major or concentration, whatever, was English?
It was English.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was English. And I tried not to be, you know, that music kid at first. But before long, Jory Graham understood that I had this other life and encouraged me to sort of deal with it in the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Why not write a poem about Carlos Kleiber? Not, you know, a biographical portrait, but a sort of image of what makes an artist like that so miraculous. Try to catch it and fail, as you always do, but try.
Mm.
Or to write a poem about the way that Mahler's Ninth Symphony moves and sort of what happens. And I found it to be a totally fertile ground for poetry, you know, the mystery of what music is, which is kind of a secret subject of a lot of poems anyway.
Right, right. You don't happen to have your Carlos Kleiber poem on you, do you?
Oh, it's not on me, but it's out there somewhere.
Okay. Does Muti know you wrote a Carlos Kleiber poem?
I'll have to tell him.
Yeah. I mean, he's, you know, really... And it's understandable when your life is on that kind of a level artistically in terms of the dedication that your work takes. If you also want, as Mr. Moody does, to have a family and to have that be important to you, and geographically how you're moving constantly, it's not uncommon that these people don't have a lot of really close friends. And I think Muti had too. Richter and Kleiber, and he speaks that you can't talk with him about anything without him mentioning both of them at least once in the conversation. And it's always apropos because they were great aphorists among other things and jokesters. So there's always when Kleiber put the joy buzzer on. No, he did basically do that. He spent a life putting joy buzzers on people's seats in all kinds of ways. But I bet he'd be intrigued. To know how you dealt with Kleiber. I'm guessing you never saw Kleiber perform.
No, unfortunately.
Right, because you're too young.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. And he only came once to the States, and it was here to Chicago.
It was here in Chicago.
Yeah,
and it didn't
concerts.
Go especially well, did it?
What have you heard?
What have you heard? Oh, well.
No, you don't need to say like...
Rumors of the usual insecurities.
I think that he just was Kleiber, but the performances were...
I'm sure the performances were amazing.
Unbelievable. I didn't have the privilege of being in the orchestra, but nobody could forget those. I mean, the electricity and the excitement and, you know, I think everyone's entitled to be crazy somewhat, and great, great artists are entitled to be as crazy as they want, as long as they get the job done.
the starting point for this poem is just an image of, actually, the piece in question was Otello, but there's a look in his eye before giving a downbeat in a video from Scala, right. I think, and there's this look of total. It's a kind of pure fear, or like, oh God, how am I gonna? Am I gonna really do this? And then it's like he jumps off a cliff and gives the downbeat. Right. It's like he's looking over a cliff and going, can I possibly go through this?
Right.
And then it happens. And so it's what fascinated me was that question of feeling like it's totally impossible that a performance could possibly happen until the instant that it starts. Mm-hmm. And then you're in a different landscape.
There's an improv comic actor in Chicago who these days does more teaching and writing about it, around my age or a little bit younger, Jimmy Corain. And I just happened to hear him on the radio today on my way to talk with you. And I guess he has a blog, and he had an article that's really been picked up by a lot of improv people called Lost in Creation. And how a student will say to him when she's doing an improv scene afterwards, I don't know that it went very well. I just got lost in it. And he said, no, you want to get lost in it. That's when the stuff comes out. Fortunately, you've got people here watching and taking notes. We can tell you what you missed while you were performing. But there, it's an interesting thing that if you have so much knowledge, quote unquote, and confidence, you're maybe not performing or preparing or presenting a piece.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to compose if I knew where the next note was coming from. You have to put the note down and, well, then you're in a situation. Right. And you have to find some honest way to work your way out of it. And that's how you look for the next note.
Well, how exciting for you, Matt O'Coin, and exciting for us to be able to watch you put down the next note and wave the next, I don't know if you conduct with or without a baton, but wave the next note and write the next notes about notes as your work as a composer, conductor, performer, and poet continues, and some of it unfolds right in front of our eyes here in Chicago, as well as in Boston, New York, and I guess Rome at least, but we'll hear about other places, and I hope we can continue to check in with you over the next couple of years as you're doing things here and elsewhere. Thank you so much.
It'd be my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Andrew.